And the first case is Personalized Media Communications, LLC versus Apple Inc., 21-2275. Counselor Martin, you reserve 3 minutes of your time for rebuttal. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
All counsel may remove their mask during argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Marlowe, we're ready to proceed when you are.
No, thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Kevin Martin on behalf of the appellant PMC. With me today, I have Thomas Scott. Your Honors, under Hyatt, an applicant can avoid prosecution latches by cooperating with the PTO to advance its applications. Within a few years of filing its applications, PMC had offered all of the cooperation that this Court found lacking in Hyatt. It had grouped its applications by subject matter, assigned them definite priority dates, reduced their number pursuant to a consolidation agreement, agreed to comply with an administrative requirement, and offered terminal disclaimers. The District Court committed a legal error by dismissing all of that cooperation as, quote, not material, and abused its discretion in finding latches under the totality of circumstances. I would like to address 3 points this morning. First, the District Court's treatment of Hyatt as a white horse case cannot be squared with this Court's actual reasoning and holding in Hyatt and the vast differences during prosecution of the two sets of applications.
What would you say is the chief difference between Hyatt and this case?
What really seemed to trouble the Court in Hyatt was the fact that after filing that many applications in 1995, Hyatt then spent 20 years trying to make matters even worse for the PTO. He agreed to cooperate with the PTO and then never followed through, multiplied the number of applications, and the PTO put in evidence that he serially violated rules and regulations that are designed to try to make prosecution move forward in a expeditious fashion. The very opposite is the case here. Certainly by the end of the 1990s, PMC had entered the consolidation agreement, which was a reasonable exercise of docket management by the PTO. It had provided in 1995, and then certainly by 1998, demarcations of its applications by subject matter, and assign them all definite priority dates. We include a sample of that table in our brief. So where Hyatt was engaged in activity that seemed designed to delay things for delay's sake, what the evidence shows is that in the 1990s, years before Apple began developing its supposed intervening rights.
What if hypothetically a patent applicant was found to very clearly engage in unreasonable delay for 15 years or so, and then for the final 5 years seemed to be a good faith player in trying to prosecute the patents that had been pending for a long time quickly to issuance? Because after all patent applicants ultimately want to get patents at the end of the day. But does in my hypothetical, the last 5 years of good faith effort absolve the applicant of the first 15 years of unreasonable delay?
So I think in a case like that, Judge Chen, you'd be looking at a cancer research situation where this court almost seemed to assume in that case that the applicant's conduct for 9 years had been an abuse of the patent system, but didn't even reach that issue because it concluded there were not intervening rights. And so in this situation, the question would become, okay, did intervening rights develop during that initial period of delay? And if they did, then there's prosecution latches. But if they did not, then just like in cancer research, the defense is not established. But again, that's not this situation. Here, Apple put in, for example, Apple and the district court focused on the period between the priority date of 1987 and the filing of the applications in 1995. There was no evidence that anyone, Apple included, developed intervening rights with respect to this patent during that 8-year period. Apple and the district court focused on the period after 2003. But by that point, prosecution of these applications was well underway. As we point out in our reply brief, and as the record shows, PMC actually had some applications allowed in the 1990s, and they paid the allowance fee on those before they were retracted. So this is not a company which is just trying to drag things out for the sake of delay.
What about where you have the the early conduct 2 decades ago that, let's say, was egregious in nature? And here, for example, the court says that PMC would prosecute its patent serially, and it goes on describing, I think you're aware of that paragraph, second, PMC would keep its patent portfolio hidden until the claim subject matter became widely adopted in the industry. And I guess that's when, you know, you spring out and seek to enforce the previously hidden patent. In a situation like that, doesn't the prior conduct, the historical conduct, come into play?
I mean, under a totality of the circumstances test, I guess the court could look at anything and afford it what weight it's due. The problem with what the district court did here was afford, in a sense, overwhelming weight to conduct that is expressly allowed by statute in the absence of any evidence that intervening rights had developed during those periods. You know, this court was very clear in Symbol Technologies too that you should not be, you know, applying this doctrine in such a way that you're vitiating statutory provisions. In our case, the law was clear for decades that you were allowed to engage in serial prosecution of continuation applications. It was a very common practice during that period. And Congress, in a sense, grandfathered that in 1995 when it did not, in the context of the grandfathering provision for the GATT implementing legislation, put in any kind of you know, maximum period. It's simply put in place the grandfathering period. I would also note,
Mr. Martin, the district court was aware of all that, and we're reviewing for abuse of discretion, are we not?
You are, Your Honor.
So under a totality of circumstances, and you're concerned about the weight that was given or not given to a particular piece of evidence, I don't know that that does it for you. How could we find an abuse of discretion in how the district court weighed all of that?
Sure, and if you look at the totality of the circumstances test and the abuse of discretion standard, both of those require the district court to focus on legally relevant factors and on evidence which is actually supported by the record. And so on the subject we were just talking about, we think if you look at Symbol 2, and if you look at the ultimate holding in Hyatt, which was not that Hyatt was guilty of latches because he filed his applications too late. The court said that Hyatt had had the chance to avoid prosecution latches if he had behaved better during prosecution. We think it's clear that simply saying, this continuation application was filed 8 years after the priority date, therefore you lose, is not the law.
Hyatt say something like the magnitude of the delay alone was enough to find that it was prima facie unreasonable?
Hyatt took into account, well, so 2 points there, Judge Chen. First, if you look at looking at the remand order, the court did not say that Hyatt's applications were dead in the water simply because he filed them too late. The court remanded with specific instructions for Hyatt to try to explain his delays.
Right, I'm just trying to remember. I thought there was one passage that pointed out that just the long period of delay from where things stood at that point in time back to the earliest priority date Mr. Hyatt was relying on was such a long span of time that alone was enough to conclude, at least at a prima facie level, that there was unreasonable delay. Am I misremembering the opinion?
There is language like that, Your Honor, but I think that also needs to be viewed in the context of Hyatt's being a Section 145 action, not involving an issued patent, which has a presumption of validity. And so when you look at what was happening in that case, you had that long initial period.
Well, Symbol Technologies, too, also had a long period of delay, and in that case, the patent, you know, owner got hit with prosecution latches, right?
He was hit by prosecution
latches. That was a granted patent.
It was a granted patent. So in the Lemelson situation, what the evidence showed was that he waited, I think, between 19 and close to 40 years, even to file the applications. And there was very strong evidence in that case that during that intervening period, he had been specifically monitoring developments in industry and crafting the claims. So what this court said was that there was strong evidence of intervening rights. Apple put in absolutely no evidence in this case that anyone was developing the technology claimed by the 091 patent between 1987 and 1995.
The decrypting method in question, the first time that was introduced into an application was in 2003. Is that right?
No, Your Honor. It was limited to decryption in 2003. But beginning, the actual claim was introduced in 1996 with enabled and disabled language, and then over the course of prosecution, enabled and disabled was narrowed to decrypted and encrypted.
And that was the same year Apple came out with FairPlay?
2003 is the same year that Apple came out with FairPlay, Your Honor. But again, Apple put in absolutely no evidence that the broader enabling and disabling language that had appeared in the claims beginning in 1996 would not have covered fair play. So if you look at a case, you know, a case like Webster, that involved a reissue patent where there was a broadening. And what was egregious in that case was that the applicant had been monitoring the industry and then broadening claims in a reissue. What we have here is a claim going in with broader language. And then as is very typical, obviously, during prosecution, it was narrowed over time. And I think there's no, even beyond Apple's failure to show that the 2003 amendment was broadening in some way, it's clearly narrowing. If you look at this court's decision the last time Apple and PMC were before the court a couple of years ago, in the IPR appeal, the question there was whether decryption is limited only to digital data and as opposed to scrambled analog data.
I don't recall. Is this an argument that was made below about whether this enable-disable signal claim necessarily and clearly encompassed encrypting, decrypting?
Well, no, Your Honor, and that's part of the problem, which is that throughout this case, we've been reacting to arguments made late or not at all by Apple. And so the question...
I'm just trying to figure out for purposes of what I'm responsible for, do I need to actually make some kind of independent inquiry as to whether or not I should understand previously filed claims here as necessarily and clearly encompassing the encrypting, decrypting method claim that was introduced in 2003.
So I think, Your Honor, what you could do for your purposes is decide that Apple put in no evidence at all, expert or otherwise, that the 2003 claim was in some ways broader, the 2003 version of the claim was some way broader than the claim that had been there since 1996.
Let's go back a little bit to the comment that you made regarding the procedural posture of this case, making it different from some of our precedent. Hyatt was a Section 145 case. This is a validity case. What explain to me, in your mind, what difference does it make?
The difference that it makes is twofold, Your Honor. This court has been clear in cases like Hyatt as well as Boghizi that at the end of the day, that the PTO was responsible for managing its docket and is given deference with respect to its docket management decisions. In Hyatt, the PTO had refused to issue patents to Mr. Hyatt. And when Mr. Hyatt brought an action challenging that, the PTO raised prosecution latches. In our case, the PTO has never raised prosecution latches against us. And when an individual examiner raised prosecution latches against us, the PTO is an organization.
But the issue of abandonment was raised in this case.
It was raised by the individual examiner, and then the PTO vacated that order. I think as much as agencies ever do apologize to us, and it's never raised it again.
My understanding is, though, that the prosecution latches rejection was withdrawn not because the supervisory examiner disagreed with the merits of that determination, but it was because the supervising examiner was under what we now know is the misimpression at the time that prosecution latches couldn't be applied by a patent examiner.
Sure, Apple argues that. There's absolutely no evidence to support that. And if you look at the timeline here, the timeline refutes it because the board's decision in Boghizi actually predated the supervisory examiner's action vacating.
The Federal Circuit Boghizi decision didn't come out till after the supervising examiner took the action.
That's true, Your Honor, but if the question is what was in the supervisory examiner's mind at the time, Apple has no evidence of what was in the supervisory examiner's mind at the time, and the evidence is that the board...
There wasn't a statement saying something like prosecution latches isn't a patentability determination and we should only be making patentability determinations?
No, Your Honor. There's not a statement that says prosecution latches is not a patentability determination. What the supervisor examiner said was that this was not undertaken subject to an investigation authorized by law or something. And if you look at Examiner Luther's memo, it's a bit of a hot mess. I mean, in addition to his comments about our conduct during prosecution, he's attacking law firms for trying to represent people in infringement litigation where they have witnesses who work for the law firm.
Can we go back to Hyatt just for a moment? The district court found that the evidence of your client's strategy of delay and submarine patents was very strong here, and I think maybe a distinction or stronger than even in Hyatt. was it an abuse of discretion to make those findings and to give that great weight?
It was, Your Honor, for at least two reasons. First, we think the evidence does not support a finding that PMC was engaged in a submarine patenting process. There was evidence that...
Is that a factual issue for us?
That's a factual issue reviewed for clear error. The evidence the district court was pointing to concerned licensing efforts in the early 1990s. And the evidence is actually extraordinarily clear that by 1992, so years before these applications were filed, a decade before the intervening rights period, PMC had surfaced. The evidence, as we walked through it in the brief, shows that we were reaching out to dozens of companies in that period, including there's evidence in Apple, to talk to them about our technology. And then the second important point in response to that question is that by 1989, our complete specification had issued. The technology was out there. And as Apple has never made it, it abandoned any 112 argument that the claims of the 091 patent were not disclosed by the specification.
Okay, we ate up all your rebuttal time with our questions, so we'll restore your rebuttal when you get back up, okay?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. O'Quinn?
Thank you, Judge Reyna. May it please the Court, John O'Quinn on behalf of Apple. Judge Chin, I want to come back to a question that you were asking about, because at the time that the supervisory examiner withdrew the notice of objection, PMC itself had specifically argued to the supervisory examiner that there was no authority to make a latches-based rejection. And you can see that at the appendix at page 21,160 to 62. And, of course, the supervisory examiner ultimately withdrew on the grounds that the notice of objection was, quote, unrelated to the issue of patentability, end quote. That's at appendix 21,282. Now, taking a step back, the district court did not abuse its discretion in weighing the facts and considering the totality of the circumstances here, concluding that as a matter of equity, prosecution latches should apply to these extreme facts which are not likely to recur given the intervening changes in the law. Now here, Hyatt did specifically say that the magnitude of delay can be enough to trigger latches. At page 1368 of the Hyatt opinion, Hyatt says that. And here, PMC has not purported to invent anything since filing its last priority application in 1987. Yet through a series of serialized, in its words...
Counselor, what difference does it make that this case arises out of the district court as opposed to Hyatt, which came up on a Section 145 type action?
Yeah, Judge Reyna, I don't think it makes any difference in terms of the ultimate inquiry here. The district court, the only difference that it may have made, the district court found that we should be held to a clear and convincing standard of evidence and found that we met that standard. I suppose that is a possible difference in terms of the posture. But I don't think that there's any other difference, and certainly not one that's material to the outcome here. I mean, here, as in Hyatt, Hyatt had allowed claims. In fact, the examiners who were handling prosecution did not raise latches. Latches was only raised as a litigation defense by the Patent Office after claims, in fact, had been allowed and a patent would have issued, except that Hyatt then took the case to district court. So I don't think there's a difference in that respect.
I suppose one other possible distinction is that, and Judge Gilstrap pointed this out, is that in Hyatt, there was a presumption of latches after a 6-year period of, let's say, unreasonable delay, and Judge Gilstrap declined to apply that presumption in this case. I mean, obviously, in a case against the PTO, that's an ex parte case. Here, this is inter partes, and so was it wrong for Judge Gilstrap to say, in these kinds of contested cases, in hotly disputed litigation, it's incumbent on the defendant to actually prove with some affirmative defense that there was prejudice to somebody somewhere.
Sure, Judge Chin. I mean, so just to take a step back, obviously Judge Gilstrap found that we met our burden with respect to the presumption, and so I don't think the court ultimately has to decide that issue in this case. But I think if you look at the reasoning in cancer research and the reasoning in Hyatt, then a presumption would apply after 6 years. And the reason that I say that is because, and that would be true in litigated cases, not just patent office cases. And the reason that I say that is the reason that cancer research found that there was a requirement to prove prejudice at all was because that was true as in every other Latches defense. I mean, that's I think verbatim the way that the court described it in cancer research at page 729 of that decision. And of course, in Hyatt, the court applied a presumption, noting that borrowing from the presumption of Latches that was described in the Wanless versus GE case. And Wanless versus GE was a litigation case. It didn't involve prosecution Latches at all. It involved litigation Latches. And it had found that a presumption of 6 years should apply. So I think
if we were to apply that presumption, when would the clock start? 6 years from what?
Well, I mean, Judge Stark, I think it would have started 6 years, I mean, arguably 6 years from 1981, certainly 6 years from 1987. You know, in this case, I don't think the court has to decide whether a presumption applies or not. This looks nothing like the case in cancer research where the patent had issued and it was years before anybody began investing in the allegedly infringing technology.
Did the entry of the GATT into force, did that reset the clock with respect to delay prior to that time?
Judge Rayner, I don't think it reset the delay. I think that the actions that PMC took as a result of the GATT bubble exacerbated the delay. I mean, you have a patent here that at a minimum claims priority is in 1987. Now they say, oh, well, we made it clear to the patent office which ones were 1987 and which ones were 1981. But in this case, even though they say it was clear to the patent office it was 1987, in this very case, you can see at Appendix 3168 that they argued that the priority date for this patent is 1981. So they were going back and forth on their priority dates. But regardless, from 1987 to the time this application was filed was 8 years. That's enough, as Hyatt said, to trigger Latches. Then you have another 8 years before you have the introduction of a claim that has encryption, decryption, or decryption keys.
Let me get this straight. Are you suggesting that if someone files a continuation application 8 years after the parent application, that's a prima facie unreasonable delay and should be potentially subject to prosecution Latches?
Judge Chin, I think that... that
sometimes prosecution does take a long
time. To be sure, and that's
what, if that's the fault of the PTO.
Absolutely, Judge Chin, that can certainly be the case, and that is why I think this court's case law is quite clear that it is number one, a totality of the circumstances test, number two, that it is a fact-intensive inquiry, and you have to look at it in the context of the overall behavior. And here, what you have is what the district court recounted, a deliberate, intentional strategy to delay as long as possible in the filing of applications until were confronted with the GATT deadline. And so this idea that it took them until 1994 or 1995 to figure out what the inventions were, as though this was like a treasure hunt through their own specification, to figure out what their inventions were, when they in fact have contemporaneous documents from that period of time saying that this was deliberate, that they were going to deliberately prosecute over time so that it was, quote, as prolonged as possible, Appendix 37731, and that they had at Appendix 37844 a long-range plan to account for the time required for the development in the marketplace. So I think that the district court here, of course, was right to take that into account in assessing not only the conduct that was occurring prior to the filing of this particular application in 1995, but then the conduct that occurred after 1995. And they make the consolidation agreement the cornerstone of their argument on appeal to suggest that somehow that precludes Latches as a matter of law. And I don't see, number one, how that could possibly be consistent with the doctrine of prosecution Latches, which is an equitable doctrine, which is reviews the totality of the circumstances and of course is reviewed for an abuse of discretion. But whatever you think of the consolidation agreement, number one, it came years after they filed this application in the patent office. Number two, it then by their own admission took them at least 18 months to complete consolidation. And you have contemporaneous statements from some of from the examiners saying that that itself was unreasonable.
Are you contending that by the time of the consolidation agreement, they had already done enough abusive conduct that they were never going to have enforceable patents?
Judge Stark, I'm saying that by the time that you got to the consolidation agreement here, and by the time you get to the conduct that the district court recounted in 2003 with respect to this patent or its ATRAC 145 application counterpart, that this was a case where latches would have been appropriate to apply. And indeed, it should be no surprise to them that latches is being asserted. It was asserted against them in 1995.
And this goes back to questions you were asked already, but no matter how good faith the patentee or the applicant acted with after, say, sometime in the 90s, they were inevitably going to end up with unenforceable patents as long as somebody could show intervening rights. Is that your contention?
And I think that after a certain period of time, given the conduct that occurred here and and what the district court found was the only reasonable explanation for the conduct here on the facts, that if someone could establish intervening rights in a relevant time period, then yes, you have a patent that's not going
to
be enforceable.
I guess related to that, if we were to affirm the district court here, would that render all of PMC's patent portfolio unenforceable, provided that somebody comes along and shows intervening rights?
Sure. No, I appreciate the question, Judge Stark. And I think the short answer is that it would certainly be relevant. Whatever this court does will be relevant to PMC's other patents. Obviously, the district court made factual findings here with respect to the totality of the circumstances and the family of patents beyond this patent. But his decision also considered the particulars of this patent and when this claim was introduced. And so not being familiar with all of the other patents that have perhaps been asserted out in the world.
So you won't be arguing collateral estoppel in trial court 2 years from now if this were to be affirmed?
Judge Chen, I mean, respectfully, I wouldn't want to prejudge any type of argument, not knowing what the prosecution history of any other patent would look like. I mean, if you were talking about, say, the 145 patent, I mean, excuse me, the 160 patent, that was the 145 application, that is the ATRAC counterpart to this patent, which was relegated to the BTRAC, and therefore, you know, put on ice for like a decade under their approach with the consolidation plan. Probably would be a very strong argument that it's really factually indistinguishable, but I wouldn't want to prejudge, other patents. I mean, they purport to have different inventions. I don't know, for example, when a particular claim would have been introduced at a particular point in time. I know in this case, it wasn't introduced into this application until 2011, and it wasn't introduced in
the A application in 2003.
Correct.
What about the other side's argument that this encryption-decryption scheme was always part of at least some of their claims that were pending in the agency many years before 2003? It's just that they narrowed the claim to the encryption-decryption embodiment.
Well, a few points in response, Judge Chin. I mean, first, if you look at Appendix 25, the district court viewed this as being materially different subject matter. It is an entirely rewritten claim. I mean, almost word for word, the claim has changed. And this court was concerned about that and, in fact, pointed to that in Hyatt itself. I mean, if you look at in the government's brief in the Hyatt case at pages 11, 12, and 15, one of the points that the government made was that, quote, claims were nearly rewritten via amendment, end quote. And this court, in recounting the sheer raw passage of time that had occurred in Hyatt, didn't just look at when the applications were filed, but also specifically at page 1367, looked at when claims were introduced, including rewritten claims. And I think, the question, of course, when a claim is introduced, whether it's via amendment or otherwise, is when are you first presenting that particular invention? And that, of course, is relevant to what is the relevant prior art, among other things. And as our double patenting expert testified at Appendix 9436, when you have a revision like that, well, it essentially resets prosecution of the claim.
So what about assuming for the moment that PMC was a fair player starting in 2003 going forward, and and Fair Play wasn't introduced until 2003. Can you say that you were prejudiced by that? Because during the time that you began commercializing Fair Play, by then PMC arguably was a fair player from that point to the finish line.
Sure, and I do want to come back to the premise of the question, because I think if you look at Examiner and Harvey's statements in 2002, which the supervisory examiner signed on to, I don't think
you're
that
running
that's
out of time.
Fair. But to answer your question, Judge Chen, I mean, you have the district court specifically found at page 39 that PMC delayed prosecution of an instruct-to-enable signal-based encryption method at the PTO until at least 2003, and so delaying prejudiced Apple, which had already begun investing in Fair Play development and continued to do so. So the district court found that there was overlap, even if you want to put a laser focus, and I don't think it's correct to do so, but even if you want to put a laser focus on the time period that they are focused on, I mean, they stipulated that development began in the early 2000s. One of our developers testified that that is when the development was had taken place, and that Apple could have done something different at the time. You can see it appendix 4711. And you don't need to have a commercialized product. I think cancer research is quite clear that the question is whether you've invested in, worked on, or used during the period of delay. Now, I don't think the period of delay here ended in 2003, not only because of the statements of Examiner Harvey, not to be confused with Inventor Harvey, but also because I think for the same reasons this court found in Hyatt that it was fair. I see I'm into my...
Go ahead. And Judge Stark also has a question to ask.
Okay. Thank you, Judge Reyna. I think for the same reasons this court found in Hyatt at page 1365 that it was fair to attribute litigation delay to in that case, Hyatt, that it's fair to attribute the delay that occurred during reexamination and we get to PMC, and the PTO spoke to that at appendix 16,857 and 19,038 among other places. And then you have the fact that they just had this parked application sitting out there, which the district court found that they wouldn't have been able to do but for their abuse in the first place, so that they could then in 2011 retread a claim with no consequence as to the start date of the time of the patent.
But if we are focused on the period of 2003 and later, what is it that you think you proved that they did that was abusive of the patent prosecution process after 2003? And in that regards, is it this 2011 amendment, which they say in their gray brief is a completely new argument that you're making and one that is incorrect? Could you just address that for me?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So Judge Stark, I mean, the district court itself found that the delay from the manner in which they prosecuted these 328 applications caused
a
delay to continue.
You have basically a spillover argument. Well, we've already talked about that. Things they did early had lasting consequences. But if we were, despite your argument, to focus like a laser on 2003 and after, what is it you think you proved that they did abusively after 2003 and thereabouts?
Yeah, so I mean, and just to and I'm sorry if I'm not answering your question directly. I mean, if you look, for example, at the appendix at 48,056, where you see the patent office continuing to struggle with, quote, precisely what it is the applicant claims. This is an office action in July of 2002 that is not responded to until January of 2003. And there is no substantive response to the concerns that were identified by Examiner Harvey and the supervisory examiner failed, signed off.
The 145A application?
This is in the 145A application. That's exactly right. And he, in fact, specifically said at appendix 48,056, same page, that applicant had declined to provide the assistance that they were looking for. And he also specifically noted at appendix 48,067, not only the unusual large number of references, I mean, there are like, I think it's some 32 pages of references here at the beginning of the patent, but noted that they were continuing to make arguments about the dates of certain references that were wrong, that were contrary to what the Patent Office had already found. And then by 2005...
Okay, Mr. O'Quinn, can you conclude your arguments?
I will. Thank you, Judge Arena. So by 2005, at Appendix 19,042, the Patent Office said that these applications still required special prosecution review procedures, still required special attention because of the concerns over potential double patenting, and it said that the petitioners have contributed to the lengthy prosecution. I thank the court for its time. I'm happy to answer any additional questions if there are any.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Martin, we're restoring your 3-minute rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. So, Your Honor, just addressing a few of the points that were raised during my friend's argument. First, there was a question about whether they're essentially arguing for a presumption of latches that could be raised in any case where where a continuation application gets filed more than 6 years after the priority date. That's effectively what they are asking for, and it's what this court did not do in Simul Technologies, and it's what this court did not do in Hyatt. In both of those cases, there had to be a showing of either intervening rights during that earlier period, which Apple never tried to argue here, and the district court did not find, or there needs to be a focus on conduct during prosecution. Now let's talk about the conduct during prosecution. You just heard extensive quotations from the 2002 examiner Harvey office action.
Are you referring to conduct post-2003?
Conduct post-2003. So if we're laser focusing on that, or even the period slightly beforehand, even though cancer research seemed to be focused really on the period of delay and not the period of delay plus some period of time, that examiner Harvey office action in 2002 was something that Apple did not identify during discovery, did not raise at trial, raised for the first time in passing in its post-trial brief. If latches is supposed to be something which concerns egregious conduct, it should not be trial by ambush. The egregious conduct should be something that jumps off the page, not something that someone pulls out for the first time in a post-trial brief. We filed a response to all of Examiner Harvey's 30 examples of conduct, all of which were substantive issues, and Apple made no effort at trial to show who was right and who was wrong, that Examiner Harvey's 30 examples actually were correct. What we can say is that once the suspension for reexaminations was lifted in 2009, we just immediately jumped right back into examination with the PTO and received dozens of applications granted within a year, even more in the years that followed, including this patent in 2012. So the PTO did not view what was going on with our prosecution of these applications as the kind of situation like a Hyatt, in which the applicant was trying to have delay for delay's sake.
How many applications are still pending?
I do not know the answer to that question, Your Honor. If there's any, it's no more than a handful. We received almost 100 applications granted in the years immediately following the lifting of that suspension for reexaminations. And I think an important point here is that PMC has consistently offered terminal disclaimers where appropriate. In the 1990s, PMC offered to terminally disclaim the 145A application to the first of any application that issued from that entire set of 1995 applications.
But weren't those claims reintroduced at a later time?
So if you were to follow Claim 13, the asserted Claim 13, that was originally introduced in the 507 application as Claim 3 in 1996. It was amended in 1997. We then had some delay for those In re Schneller rejections. Once we got over that, we then negotiated the consolidation agreement. Claim 3, as of 1997, was moved to the 145A application in 2000. So it wasn't just introduced in 2000 the way the district court thought. It was then amended in 2003. Apple never showed that that amendment was egregious because it was broadening in the way this court thought would be a problem, or the Supreme Court thought was a problem in Webster. So basically they're setting up a situation where if you have even routine narrowing claim amendments to get past the prior art more than a few years after the priority date, there's going to be a prosecution latches defense.
On the prejudice prong, did we review the district court there for abuse of discretion as well? Or is there a question of law here about this laser focus concept, which we've all now talked about, like what period we would look to for the delay?
So we think it was an abuse of law, a error of law, Your Honor. We think it's an abuse of discretion. Broadly, abuse of discretion includes both errors of law and clear errors of fact. And we think it was an error of law for the district court to point to that 2003 amendment narrowing amendment, or at least certainly not shown to be broadening, and to say that that somehow supports a prosecution.
Is the error of law looking at the time frame before Apple developed intervening rights, or is it some additional error of law?
The error of law is not looking at the reason for the amendment, essentially saying there was an amendment, and therefore that constitutes latches in some way. If the amendment was not broadening, it's impossible for them to show prejudice.
Okay, we thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So we thank the parties for their arguments.